Thank you very much, Chris. Ladies and gentlemen, the concept of New World Order, the concept of the New World Order, dates from 9/11, because it was on the 11th of September 1990 that the elder President Bush proclaimed it. He proclaimed the New World Order just after Iraq occupied Kuwait and as the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union were collapsing. And when he proclaimed it, what he meant was that the world would no longer be divided into two halves, as it had been since 1945, and also that henceforth, because of the end of the division, international law could be used in a radically new way, and in particular, it could be used in a criminalizing way and in order to punish states who disobeyed it. The first implementation of that new understanding of international law was, of course, the war against Iraq. And while one could argue that the attempt to repel Iraqi troops from Kuwait fitted into the old system of international relations, in the sense that Iraq had committed a violation of national sovereignty, I will leave aside for the purposes of this discussion facts of which I'm sure many of you are aware concerning the role of the Americans in the original invasion and indeed, of course, Iraq's own offer to withdraw before the war started. But for the purposes of this judicial discussion, we could perhaps say that the action taken after the proclamation of the New World Order fitted into the old system of international relations whereby the primary rule was the protection of national sovereignty. However, as we know, that rapidly became something totally different. In particular, after the Iraq War, the notion of crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, was invoked for the first time after Kurds fled to the mountains in Turkey to justify the regime of punitive sanctions under which Iraq suffered for the next decade. And of course, legally speaking, it was, if we can use the word legally in the context of the Iraq War of 2003, it was those resolutions voted at the time of the proclamation of the New World Order which allegedly provided the legal justification for the attack in 2003. In other words, the key point about the New World Order from a judicial point of view is that it criminalizes international relations. It turns international law from a contractual arrangement between sovereign states with no superior enforcement powers into something which is effectively indistinguishable from the criminal procedure of a domestic state. And that is what is meant. That is what President George Bush Sr. meant when he proclaimed the New World Order. And we can see the effects of that very clearly. Everybody knows about Guantanamo Bay. What is shocking about Guantanamo Bay, again, I'm leaving aside as much as is possible a certain number of factual considerations, but what is shocking from a legal point of view, from an international law point of view, is that the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay are considered to be criminals. This is a radical departure from the traditional laws of war. The traditional laws of war do not consider that a soldier fighting in a hostile army is by definition a criminal. On the contrary, the Geneva Conventions, which provide for the treatment of prisoners of war, clearly came into existence precisely because people held in detention as prisoners of war are not considered to be criminals as such. Again, they may have done things which are bad, but the mere fact of being criminals, the mere fact of being soldiers, does not render them criminal. However, in the War on Terror, they are. The War on Terror, as an expression, illustrates perfectly this radical reform of international relations which occurred in 1990. Why does it illustrate that? Because terror, by definition, is a criminal activity, and war is, by definition, an interstate activity. So by proclaiming the War on Terror, George Bush Jr. has given perfect expression to this complete confusion between international relations, in other words, the relations between states, and the criminal procedure of a state. Or to put it in another way, he has proclaimed a new international system which treats the entire world as if it were the part of the domestic jurisdiction of the United States of America. And that's why anybody who fights in whatever capacity, and indeed in whatever country, is regarded as a criminal. Now, it's obvious that the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia comes directly out of this logic. It comes directly out of this transformation of the free association between states, which used to constitute international law, into something resembling the criminal procedures of a state. And the justification for this criminalization of international relations is usually held to be the trials at Nuremberg, held in 1945 after the defeat of Nazi Germany. In fact, it's difficult to exaggerate the role which the Nuremberg jurisprudence plays in the ICTY trials. There are masses of references to Nuremberg in the various judgments. The name of the tribunal, International and Tribunal, is obviously taken from the International Military Tribunal, which was the name of the court that tried the Nazi leaders. People associated with the Holocaust have put their pennyworth into the various hearings. Elie Wiesel, for example, appeared, the disembodied anyway, on a video link during the trial, during the sentencing of Mrs. Tasich. And indeed, one could say, frankly, that of all the many perversities of the Milosevic trial, none is perhaps more striking than this extraordinary charge that he was pursuing a greater Serbia. I can only think for my own part that this does indeed come from the attempt to impose the Nuremberg jurisprudence on what happened in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. It's almost like putting an unfitting suit, a large suit, onto a small man, or the other way around. Obviously, the Nazis were accused and convicted of creating a Greater Germany. And so it almost seems as if the people in The Hague have simply taken the Nuremberg tribunal, the Nuremberg jurisprudence, off the peg and tried to fit it onto the events of 60 years later. But in spite of this constant invocation of Nuremberg as the justification for the criminalization of international law, what I would like to try to show this afternoon is that, in fact, the Nuremberg tribunals did precisely the opposite. I referred a moment ago to the fact that prior to the proclamation of the New World Order, you were not considered to be, by definition, a criminal if you fought, if you were a soldier in a foreign army. This, in Latin, is the concept of justus hostis. An enemy is just inasmuch as he is an enemy. He is not a criminal in virtue of being an enemy. And this notion came from the juridical fact that the world is divided up into different jurisdictions. And so, jurisdictionally, it was impossible to say if somebody from another jurisdiction was a criminal. Moreover, war was more or less accepted as an inevitable part of international relations, and there was no overarching judicial authority which enabled people to say whether somebody was criminal or not. In other words, the law reflected the view that the world was made up of sovereign states. The Nuremberg jurisprudence actually, far from undermining that idea, far from undermining the idea that the world was divided up into sovereign states, in fact based the whole of its jurisprudence on it. It based the whole of its jurisprudence on the idea that the world was divided up into sovereign states. It did this because it did it for a reason, and it did it in a way. The reason why it did it is that the Nazis themselves had, of course, radically questioned, both in their acts and in their writings, the notion of state sovereignty. The Nazis invoked overriding concerns for human rights. When they issued the ultimatum and when they ultimately occupied Czechoslovakia. Same thing for the proclamation of war on Poland. In both cases, the justification was that German minorities, which had been left outside the Reich after Versailles, were being abused by the states that now occupied those territories, that now were, sorry, not occupied, but now were on that territory. In other words, the entire war effort, the entire Nazi war effort, had as its starting point the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, perversely used, of course, but that was the doctrine. And as has been said already by many speakers, the primary crime of which the Nazis were accused and convicted was, of course, crime against peace, the crime of planning and executing a war of aggression. And this is the central juridical fact of the Nuremberg trials. All the other aspects of the Nuremberg trials flow from it as logical deductions from the primary accusation of waging an aggressive war and thereby infringing state sovereignty. One of the things that flows from it, and was quite clearly discussed in the judgments and in the interpretations that were given of the Charter even before the trials began, was that nothing which happened before the war started on the 1st of September 1939 could be adjudicated by the Nuremberg trials. The Nuremberg trials tried the laws of war, and therefore no acts committed before the 1st of September 1939 were adjudicated by them, because since they were applying the laws of war, clearly, until a state of war occurred, no actions committed before that date fell under the tribunal's jurisdiction. And therefore, although the Nuremberg trials did, of course, try acts which were not covered by the existing laws of war, in particular, of course, crimes against humanity. The laws of war, by the way, people talk about Nuremberg as being an innovatory tribunal and so on. The laws of war are extremely ancient, and when I say extremely ancient, I mean, you know, you can find 13th century precedents for laws against pillage and other excesses that are committed by soldiers in wartime. But the fact is that the other crimes which were not covered by the laws of war, that were prosecuted by Nuremberg, in particular crimes against humanity, were only prosecuted to the extent that the judges in the prosecution considered that they formed part of the overall plan to carry out an aggressive war. In other words, people today, and I just ask you to dwell for a moment on this rather slightly Byzantine or Baroque reasoning, because I think we have to say that the Nuremberg jurisprudence was, shall we say, imaginative. Please dwell for a moment on the fact that those who invoke the Nuremberg trials in justification of present trials for crimes against humanity are overlooking the fact that crimes against humanity were only tried at Nuremberg inasmuch as they were considered to have formed part of the overall plan to conduct and carry out, to plan and carry out an aggressive war. In other words, if there had not been that accusation at the center of the Nuremberg trials, then crimes against humanity would not have been prosecuted. This point came out very clearly in the Nuremberg trials themselves, in other words, in the trials of the 20 Nazi leaders, the trials which started in November 1945 and finished in, I think, May 1946. When in the Göring trial, the tribunal ruled as follows, I quote, insofar as the inhumane acts charged in the indictment and committed after the beginning of the war did not constitute war crimes, they were all committed in execution of or in connection with aggressive war and therefore constituted crimes against humanity. In other words, we can see quite clearly in the rulings that crimes against humanity were justiciable only to the extent that they constituted part of the overall plan to commit an aggressive war. Now this leads to some very surprising conclusions. Surprising really only because we have forgotten, in fact, how intelligent the Nuremberg judicial reasoning was. You see, today the people who justify the proceedings in The Hague say, well, a lot of horrible things happened. Somebody must be held to account for them. That is not a judicial reasoning. That is the reasoning at best of a vigilante. But we have had so much of this now that it is surprising and I think refreshing to dwell for a moment on how juridically intelligent the Nuremberg rulings were. For example, in the 1947 trial of judges, because after the end of the main Nuremberg trials, the Americans in their sector carried on a number of other trials, which went on for a couple of years after 1946. And one of them was of judges and members of the officials in the Ministry of Justice who were prosecuted for having passed various laws, which it was alleged, and they were convicted, of course, in many cases, had been the instrument of racial persecution and so on. This trial, by the way, the one I'm talking about in 1947, is the one that the film was made about, Judgment at Nuremberg, with Spencer Tracy and Marlene Dietrich. Anyway, in the actual trial itself, the judges made the following very interesting remarks about the relationship between the universality of a crime and the right of judicial organs to prosecute it. I quote, "This universality and superiority of international law," the judges said, "does not necessarily imply universality of its enforcement." They went on, "The law is a universal, but such a state reserves unto itself the exclusive power within its boundaries to apply or withhold sanctions." And they concluded as follows, and this is of direct relevance to the Hague Tribunal's issuing of an indictment against a sitting head of state. They concluded as follows, "In Germany, an international body, the Control Council, has assumed and exercised the power to establish judicial machinery for the punishment of those who have violated the rules of common international law, a power which no international authority without consent could assume or exercise within a state having a national government presently in the exercise of its sovereign powers." I'll just repeat that quotation. "In Germany, an international body has assumed and exercised the power to establish judicial machinery for the punishment of those who have violated the rules of common international law. But this power," in other words, the power to punish people, "is a power which no international authority without consent could assume or exercise within a state having a national government presently in the exercise of its sovereign powers." In other words, this ruling of the 1947 Nuremberg trial clearly states that however abhorrent the alleged crimes are, it is juridically not possible to prosecute them on a state where, as was obviously the case in Yugoslavia in 1999, where a state is in possession of a sovereign body. Now, the point is, of course, that in the Nuremberg case, the Allies simply said that they were the holders of sovereign power in Germany. And indeed, what we must never forget in discussing the Nuremberg trial is that prior to the end of the war, or rather the end of the war came when Germany did something which no other state, as far as I know, has ever done, ever in the entire history of international relations. Maybe I'm wrong. And that is offered what is known as an unconditional surrender. The unconditional surrender, Bedingungslose Kapitulation, meant that there was literally no German government. And so that is why, of course, when the Allies arrived and took control of Germany, they considered that, legally speaking, they were the holders, the temporary holders, of sovereignty in Germany. This is completely unlike the normal rules of occupation in a state. Indeed, the judges at Nuremberg drew the distinction between their presence in Germany after 1945 and, say, the presence of German troops in Poland after 1939. In other words, without unconditional surrender, it is simply juridically not possible to prosecute crimes against humanity. Now, these points are not just a matter of ancient history. They continue to inform international law, in other words, not what the Hague Tribunal administers, the ICTY, up right to our very day. I'm sure many of you in this room are familiar with the 1986 case, Nicaragua versus the United States of America, of 1986, where Nicaragua took the United States to the International Court of Justice for the abuses committed by the Contras. Now, that ruling is an extremely interesting one for two reasons. One of them has nothing to do with my own talk, but just I'll mention it because it is so relevant, particularly, of course, to the indictments for Croatia and Bosnia. As I'm sure you know, the court found that although the Contras had been entirely created and set up by the United States, and although, by the way, the United States even refused to appear in the hearings and represent its own position, the court found that the United States could not be held legally responsible for atrocities committed by the Contras. In other words, the threshold of command responsibility in existing international law is extremely high. Nobody doubted that the Contras had been created by the United States, but it was nonetheless deemed by the judges that the control exercised over them was not sufficient to warrant command responsibility. And that's of obvious relevance to the indictments for Bosnia and Croatia, or obviously command responsibility in a foreign country between Yugoslavia and, or between Serbia and Croatia is an issue. But I mentioned that only in passing. What I really want to say is that this same judgment also concluded that humanitarian intervention was completely incompatible with the existing rules of national sovereignty. This is 1986. And it found, I quote, "The court stated that there is no rule in customary international law permitting another state to exercise the right of collective self-defense on the basis of its own assessment of the situation." Although the Americans didn't contest the case, nonetheless their arguments were discussed by the judges. And so the judges found that even invoking self-defense was not enough, because of course a country, or at least that's what it said, could not be a judge in its own cause. But then even more radically, the same court concluded this. The court reaffirmed that there does not exist a new rule opening up a right of intervention by one state against another on the ground that the latter has opted for some particular ideology or political system, that alleged violations of human rights could not be taken as justification for the use of force, since the use of force could not be the appropriate method to monitor or ensure respect for human rights. In other words, this ruling from very recently, from 1986, totally rules out humanitarian intervention as being incompatible with national sovereignty, exactly as Nuremberg had done in 1945. Indeed, in 2002, the International Court of Justice ruled on a case between Congo and Belgium. Belgium, you may recall, decided that in a wonderful moment of imperial Belgian hubris, that its courts would have universal jurisdiction and that they would be able to rule on things over the entire planet. The Belgian judicial system more nearly ground to a halt because everybody filed complaints about their favorite enemy. So complaints were filed against General Pinochet and Fidel Castro and Slobodan Milosevic and everybody. And more importantly, the American administration told Belgium that if it pursued its indictments against Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld, then NATO would be put in Warsaw or somewhere, and Belgium would lose an important source of income. So that all came to an end. But before it came to an end, Belgium issued an arrest warrant against a man who, at the time of the arrest warrant, was the Foreign Minister of Congo, of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it ruled that this international arrest warrant was illegal and instructed Belgium to withdraw it. I quote, "Belgium committed a violation in regard to the Democratic Republic of Congo on the rule of customary international law concerning the absolute inviolability and immunity from criminal process of incumbent foreign ministers and in so doing it violated the principle of sovereign equality among states. In other words, the principle of sovereign immunity, which is of course another way of saying that the world is divided up into different jurisdictions, remains an active part of international law, even in 2002, in other words, even a decade after the creation of the International Criminal Tribunal. And part of the judgment is extremely, again, intelligent, I think, in explaining why immunity from prosecution does not mean impunity. People who advocate the Hague Tribunal and the other ad hoc tribunals always say, oh, well, we can't allow people to commit atrocities with impunity. And because the two words sound the same, impunity and immunity, they behave as if they are the same thing, but they're not the same thing. They're not even the same word. And the judgment ruled on this very sensibly. It said, I quote, "The court emphasizes that the immunity from jurisdiction enjoyed by incumbent ministers for foreign affairs does not mean that they enjoy impunity in respect of any crimes they may have committed, irrespective of their gravity. Jurisdictional immunity may well bar prosecution for a certain period or for certain offences. It cannot exonerate a person to whom it applies from all criminal responsibility." In other words, the problem with the Belgian arrest warrant was not that the gentleman who was Prime Minister of Congo may or may not have done horrible things for which he shouldn't get off lightly, but instead that Belgium quite simply did not have jurisdiction over Congo and as such had no right to issue such a warrant. And as I say, this is a judgment from 2002, and it shows that the issue is completely live in international law, and that the Hague Tribunal is in that sense in breach of international law by continuing to behave as if it had been rescinded. I'd like to conclude by saying that when people defend national sovereignty, as I do, I make the point, by the way, that everything I've said is, so far, is factual. I've simply told you what the law is, as far as I understand it. I'm now going to express an opinion on about why I think it's a good thing, but I make that distinction because one of the many perversities of the Hague Tribunal is that it does not operate on what the law is, but instead on what it would like the law to be, a form of behavior which is about as perfect an expression of lawlessness as one can imagine. When people talk about national sovereignty, as Nuremberg did, and as international law has done ever since, it does so, I think, for two extremely important and desirable reasons. The first is that by accepting in international law that the world is divided up into different jurisdictions, in other words, that there are different states, which is in any case a fact, we give judicial credence, we lend credence to the idea that there is or could be a balance of power between states. In other words, we say it is a good thing that power is diffused between different states exercising jurisdiction over different parts of the world. I said at the beginning of my talk that the New World Order began and was facilitated precisely when the counterbalance to American power collapsed in 1991. So I think, generally speaking, it is a good thing that power be diffused. I'm less sanguine than some other speakers today about the desirability of the International Criminal Court operating, because I fear that it will behave as badly as the ICTY. But also more generally because I think that the centralization of power can itself lead to greater abuses, whereas if power is separated among different states, then that potential is perhaps lessened. But the second reason, and I think this really is in many ways the most frightening aspect of the attacks on sovereignty, when we talk about the sovereignty of the state, we do not mean, as the enemies of sovereignty say, simply the discretionary executive power of a state. When sovereignty is attacked, its enemies always say, but sovereignty is nothing but a shield for human rights abuses. What they're talking about is the abusive, use of executive power in a state. But state sovereignty does not refer simply to executive power. State sovereignty is being a characteristic of a state, refers not only to its executive power, but much more importantly to the whole constitution of the state, including, of course, its judicial functions. And so those people who say that state sovereignty should be abolished, which is effectively what the ideologues of the ICTY say, are saying that states should be abolished in their judicial existence as much as in their executive powers. And that is why the powers wielded by the Hague Tribunal are so profoundly incompatible with law, because they are aimed at the destruction of states as embodiments of jurisdiction as much as of executive power. And that's why I conclude, I'd like to quote, or rather misquote, I don't remember who invented the phrase, was it Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton? I think the concept of rogue states, which has informed so much of American foreign policy, should in fact be applied to the Hague Tribunal. Anybody who looks at international law, by that I mean the ICJ, customary international law, and the facts of the world, can see that this is a rogue tribunal and therefore ought to be dissolved. Thank you. Dr.